the affection for what we're doing, I think, ought to be more apparent, if only because it may not be revelatory of the work so much as of the writer. I want to hear other scholars thinking. I want them to be not to take recourse to, you know, demanding that I feel as they feel, but I want to know how they feel, and I want that to be center stage, if you like, not backstage.
Romana Huck teaches in the English department at the University of Notre Dame, where she also serves as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Religion and Literature, a prominent journal in literary studies. A former guest of the BYU Humanities Center, she spoke with me about her experience teaching at a religious university, her time working with the Journal of Religion and Literature, and her outlook on scholarship in the field. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Roman, it's good to see you again. It's been a couple of years since you were out here at BYU, but it's really, really great to take the time to talk to us. Thank you so much.
And good to see you, Matt.
On a podcast titled Faith and Imagination, I usually ask our guests how they imagine faith in their own lives. Do you consider yourself a person of faith?
Oh, yes. Deeply so, for as long as I can recall. Thinking about this question, which you kindly gave me beforehand, made me remember that, you know, poetry actually came into my life because of it. I think that I was early drawn to poetry as a familiar kind of language for me because it was so full of just astonishment at being in the world and gratefulness for the gift of the world. So I've always been drawn to that particular kind of medium. I would say that though of deep faith, I'm not necessarily faithful to one particular set of precepts or conceptions of God. My grandfather was a Ukrainian Catholic priest, and my family was very devout, survived the war, coming to here from Ukraine as refugees. So I have a kind of seated belief system. But I've also been very interested in many religions' ways of thinking about God. So I think sometimes we're uncomfortable of remembering that God is multilingual and multicultural. But I think that God speaks in many ways, and that might make me a good editor of a journal like Religion and Literature, which is also interested, yes, across the board in the ways that God communicates with us.
Absolutely. That really resonates with me. I think that's actually an important precept. I think for many faith traditions, actually, is to recognize kind of to feel holy envy, right, for the things that are found in other traditions and other ways of seeing the world and seeing God. Do you imagine faith having a place then in your own work at the university, or do you kind of keep your university work and your beliefs, your faith, separate from each other?
No, I can't do that. I never have, and I'm very lucky to be teaching at a university that allows me to be teaching courses in religion and literature pretty much exclusively at this point, so that, you know, it is it's what students are drawn to me for, largely. No, I can't separate the two. I mean, I think gratitude being probably a ground beat for me is a shaping force for me, and it causes me to do almost everything I do in terms of what I want to give back. And courses take the shape of that giving as well. So almost everything I do is sprouting from the faith that I have.
Gratitude, that's a lovely sentiment. And what a nice way to find an impetus for your work at the university. That's really nice. Now, you earned your PhD at Notre Dame, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And now you're there again right now teaching a member of faculty at Notre Dame. What's your route to get from PhD to where you are? Did it go directly from a PhD program into the department, or did it have a detour somewhere else?
Oh, vast detours, but Notre Dame doesn't seem to let me go. In fact, I'm just now negotiating for a grave spot for myself, because I think I should just stay here. I could go on forever about how Notre Dame has saved me at various points in my life, but yes, I did the PhD here late 1980s, and was working then on the Neoplatonic mystical poet Kathleen Raine, a British poet well known overseas, And, you know, I think my career has gone through all of the vicissitudes of literary studies, because my first post, you know, there were posts to be gotten then, and I went to University of New Hampshire for 15 very wonderful years, but at a secular institution, and I fell in love with literary theory. I was a deconstructionist, you know, I think I believed in deconstruction in a way that I don't even believe in necessarily the precepts of the church anymore. So I went through all of that, and I think I feel lucky to live in the era I live in, because at the end of the 1990s, as you know, maybe even earlier, it registered in lots of people's work, by the early 1990s, the rapprochement between what seemed like irreconcilable, contradictory points of view between deconstructive, anti-totalitarian ways of thinking that so attracted me, and the beliefs that have only gotten stronger over the course of my life seem to come into the same arc. And by the time we are at the end of the millennium, no doubt in its odd way, allowing us to think differently about these seeming contradictories, these absolutes, brought together my two, you know, favorite swimming pools, so to speak, so I could swim in them both. And it was at that time that I came back to Notre Dame in 2002 and began to think religion and literature at a place that, you know, made it easy because it respects belief. It could be difficult, as you might remember, at places that were not universities, faith universities before that. But Notre Dame made it easy for me to make the transition and to bring it all with me. I didn't have to at that point, relinquish anything that drew me. And so I'm a lucky scholar.
I feel that myself here at BYU. What you say really resonates. Also, I've got to say, when you talked about your belief in theory, that also reminds me of my own journey. In a former life, almost seems that it's been so long now for me since I was a graduate student, but I actually took a course from Jacques Derrida, you know, who reputed as, you know, the founder of deconstruction, you know, kind of the philosopher most widely associated with deconstruction. And I used to joke, I did deconstruction instead of doing therapy, you know, it's kind of how I So, but in your case, I think that you... Really, if it was in 2002, you're back at Notre Dame and you're working through these two different areas together in terms of belief, in some ways you kind of predated even a lot of the most obvious turn toward the post-secular, which is quite remarkable. So you kind of, in some ways, anticipated, Romano, where a lot of the field was going to be moving. That said, you know, in your time back at Notre Dame, so 2002, and here we are 2021, has your career at Notre Dame taken the course that you thought it would, or have there been unexpected turns since you've been back?
Well, let me just correct you on one thing. I'm no prophet, and I don't think I anticipated anything. I think that I followed the poets, really, at the millennium, into the kinds of thinking that I was able to do at that time. I think they anticipated, antennae that they are, and a lot of poets, Jewish Buddhist to Christian, that I work on, were at that time, as they put it, coming out, able to come out as religious writers, even though they had been avant-garde, postmodernist poets devoted to post-structuralist thinking. Their ability to negotiate all of those different ways of thinking and bring them back into the faith realm was, you know, revelatory for me, very revelatory. So I'm lucky again to be working on the kinds of thing I work on. I am surprised. In my first years at Notre Dame, I was finishing a book on the British poet Stevie Smith, who called herself a backslider as a non-believer. So she wasn't quite a religious poet. And I was finishing a collection of essays on avant-garde poetics, transatlantic avant-garde poetics. I'd run a big conference and put together a collection from that that's become well-known, called Assembling Alternatives. So yeah. I was deep in secular thinking largely, and devoted to still working on avant-garde poetics and prosody, if you can use that word in the same sentence as avant-garde. But at around that time, my wonderful colleague, Susanna Monta, came to the university, and she was hired specifically to help us think about creating a minor in philosophy, religion, and literature, and to take over the journal Religion and Literature, which had been going since really 1977. But she took it by the nape of its neck and turned it into, I think, the international journal of some importance that it is today. And Susanna and I obviously hit it off early on. She works on early modernist lyric, and I work on postmodernist lyric, but that makes us a good conversation partners. So we became interested in helping each other, I think. And when she ran the big conference in 2009 that gave rise to our biggest issue of the journal on what is religion and literature, a kind of field exploratory issue. I was there with her in London at the conference that she ran, and got to know folks like Rowan Williams, to whom we gave a Life Achievement Award. And I think at that point in time, I was ruminating about writing a book like the one that I've just finished. But it wasn't top burner yet. So I think it has been a bit of a surprise to me that my life has become almost entirely devoted now to this field.
We'll get to talking about your work at the journal. I think it really is such an important journal, and you do a great job there, Ramana. And it's a benefit to everybody who works in the field. So there's a widespread gratitude for the work that you do there. One more thing about religious universities. Now, you and I both work at religious universities, and I'm curious about your experience there. Would you consider to be one significant challenge of teaching at a religious university by comparison with, say, a public university where you worked before? And what might be a real benefit of working at a religious university?
You know, I'm trying to think of a downside. And I don't know that I can. Now, once again, you have to remember that I'm pretty much in love with this place. I think it's quite marvelous. That may not be the experience of all faculty members here, but it's been good to me. I find that because it's educational philosophy largely takes its cue from Thomas Aquinas and is open to knowing everything. In the College of Arts and Letters, our motto is study everything, do anything. The openness of the students to anything that I introduce them to, whether it's Friedrich Nietzsche or Martin Heidegger or some of my favorite theologians, is they're omnivorous, like Aquinas was to a great extent, at least for a guy of his time. So I don't find that teaching here, existing here as the kind of scholar I am, has any problems related with it. I think the benefit is, again, as I suggested earlier very briefly, I think, you know, the openness to belief is refreshing, and it allows many kinds of beliefs to coexist rather peacefully on our campus, which is very nice to see. But I also, I like having, you know, 84% of our students be very devout, because then I can poke them in lots of ways that get up their nose. That's not a mixed metaphor. I really love troubling them, and they like being troubled. And I think they want to be troubled. They like to read things outside their comfort zone, and yet they can come back to their comfort zone. And so they're really very flexible young scholars, and they can think at remarkable altitudes, because they come back home, even if home is a bit changed after they've read other things. And myself, believing as I do in faith's need to evolve, and evolutionary faith even within a single lifetime, it pleases me to see them grow and be able to take more things on board than they would have liked to have read, but not be troubled by them in the end.
That's a beautiful answer. That's something I've thought about myself quite a bit. I'm really grateful you began that answer by saying that you're trying to think of the downside, and it was difficult to think of one. I know my first year at BYU, this is back in 2000, it was the winter of 2000. I was off to a conference, and I got to the airport, and I recognized a scholar from another university that I knew, and we I took a cab to the hotels from the airport, you know, to kind of split the cab fare. And I listened to her tell me about all the things I was not able to do at a religious university, things I couldn't teach because they were too, you know, too avant-garde or too edgy or something. And I thought, that's funny because I taught all those things a semester. And I do find there are students at BYU, like your students are remarkable. In fact, some of our BYU students have become your students at Notre Dame, which has been nice to see. Let me go to the journal and ask you a couple questions about the journal Religion and Literature. We had Ann Snyder on this podcast a few weeks ago, and Ann Snyder is the editor-in-chief of the Public Theology magazine Comment. I asked her this question, I'll ask this of you too. What is the journal that you found when you began serving as editor-in-chief, and what's the journal you're hoping to create?
The journal I found is one that, as I was saying a moment ago, Susanna Monta picked up and brushed off and made really quite marvelous. It was largely devoted to medieval and early modern writing, I should say, scholarship about such writing, and perhaps, you know, some of the earlier literatures, 18th to 19th century. It didn't have a lot of work on contemporary writing, and I don't know whether that is actually the case across other journals in the field, but with my coming into the editorship, just simply my presence, we began to get much more in the way of work on contemporary writing, and again, with the boom in thinking about the culture's return to religion, we found many, many more scholars wanting to contribute. In fact, our submissions are skyrocketing these days, and again, much more from across the world and in contemporary literatures. So I think that that's one thing I've been happy to foster, because I do think that we need the full breadth of thinking in the journal. There are many desires that we have in my editorial, among my editorial staff and the board and so forth, to continue to work toward a different kind of scholarship. And I think maybe jump-started by a forum we ran not too long ago on post-critical writing by
Rita Felsky. Yeah, that was a great forum.
Exactly. I think we feel devoted to, you know, encouraging into being maybe a different kind of scholarship. And we don't really know what that is yet. We're trying to be more open to maybe not the confessional work that our journal and, say, a journal like Literature and Theology also hope to dissuade, because we don't feel that that's really the place that our journal wishes to be, a place of competing voices, but rather collaborative ones. But I'm intrigued by the idea that we might move toward a different kind of writing in religion and literature studies. And so that's what we're formulating. We're all talking about it and thinking about ways that we might create fora or conferences around the issue once we can have conferences again.
That's really provocative. It's really provocative. You know, one of our guests a few weeks ago, David Mahan at Yale, and he talked about what he's trying to do in his own work in theopoetics and Christian poetics. And as he put it, it's not so much about trying to territorialize a place as belonging to religion exclusively. It's more about trying to enhance the things that you look at through religion by asking large questions that religion historically asks, and in some ways philosophically asks, with great deftness and dexterity. And it leads me to this question here. I'm interested in how you envision consequential work in the field of religion and literature. I mean, do you believe that the best work in religion and literature should be as good as scholarship anywhere, or do you believe that the best work in religion and literature should have a different kind of quality about it as a function of its subject matter?
That's such an interesting question, because it makes me wonder, should the particular angle taken relieve it of being as good scholarship as other kinds of scholarship? And I don't know why it would. In many ways, I think that work in religion and literature has to be twice as good given its interdisciplinary character, and Certainly one of the things I find as editor-in-chief, which can be very painful at times, is that I need to reject work which has not kept up, you know, in one of the fields that are at play. And you know, it might be a brilliant literary essay, but it doesn't quite bring in the theological questions that one would expect, and vice versa. So the versatility of the thinking has got to be top-notch, doesn't it? But when I think about, again, the idea that perhaps we might look at things a different way, perhaps even with, you know, a different kind of affectivity, if I can use that word, almost co-naturality, to get back to St. Thomas Aquinas, a kind of love of, rather than desire to carve out, you know, some of those terrible metaphors which suggest violence and finality, the affection for what we're doing, I think, ought to be more apparent, if only because it may not be revelatory of the work so much as of the writer.
Yeah.
And I think we do want to know each other more. What you're doing right now with a podcast, which is asking me to speak spontaneously, not my forte, but but I am revealing myself, and I think we want to know each other. We want to know other selves thinking about these things. I think, you know, certainly poetry poetic philosophy and theology in the 20th century has been so aware that ontology is such an important realm of study for those of us who wish to deepen our faiths. We want to understand human being, and we want a certain level of honesty in coming at things which may have a high degree of subjectivity, but not uninformed subjectivity. So I want to see other, I want to hear other scholars thinking. I want them to be, not to take recourse to, demanding that I feel as they feel, but I want to know how they feel. And I want that to be center stage, if you like, not backstage in the scholarship. I think we should be honest in this realm. It doesn't mean any less rigorous or impressive as scholars.
I love that answer, Ramon. I think that's really insightful. I know that in my role as a director of a humanities center, and just I kind of by habit, perhaps, I read pretty widely across fields. And the best scholarship in many fields of literature and criticism and theory interests me a lot and engages me aesthetically. I do find, though, that scholarship in religion and literature does that too, but it affects me the most when it moves me. Not necessarily because I feel exactly as the writer feels, but because I understand something about what they hold or regard as sacred, or especially or of having a value that is intensified as a function of its subject matter or its commitment. I find that to be something compelling that I think a lot of fields try to duplicate, but that's more available inside of religion and literature. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, so you point out when you became the editor-in-chief of Religion and Literature, you know, there was really good work being done by your predecessor, Susanna Monta, and you saw a lot of submissions in like medieval or early modern. Are there kinds of submissions that even right now you wish you saw more often, whether we're talking about fields or approaches or genres?
Oh, gosh. Thank you for letting me be a commercial as well. Oh,
that's
yes.
That's why I'm here, Ramona.
Well, if only we could get more submissions on, for example, Islamic writing. That's something that people don't tend to come to us for, and I'm sad about that. And we are working hard to make sure that our desires in that regard are better known. Lots of Eastern religions. We're getting more and more input from Buddhist scholars, etc. But we would love more. And what is really exciting to me is that we are getting lots of international work from the depths of Africa, South America, across Asia. That's been very exciting, and that also calls up for us sometimes editorial decisions which are difficult because the writing may be of a different kind of scholarly texture. You know, so here again, the question of what's able to be done in religion and literature might be broader than in other fields because of the desire for inclusivity at our journal, at any rate. And we're seeing that coming. You'll be seeing it in future issues. And we are also finally going digital. So at last the journal will be more available in places that don't have library access as easily. So yes, I think we just want more of everyone involved. We want to feel more global. That would be a great thing to achieve before I step down.
Fantastic. You know, the quality of the articles in your journal, Religion and Literature, is already so high. As it gets more global and as more things come in, you know, across a greater diversity of kinds of writing and traditions and the rest of it, I wonder whether there won't be room even for more journals in the field, you know? Because the big journals in the field right now, Religion and Literature, Christianity and Literature, Literature and Theology, there's a journal ever out of BYU. It's not as large, but it still publishes good work in the field of literature and belief. You wonder if there wouldn't be even more journals than that, or do you think it's better to have fewer journals that are more exclusive in what they publish?
Oh, gosh. Let a thousand flowers bloom. No, I can't see anything useful about, you know, just a few of these kinds of outlets. I wish there were many more. I would like to see them in conversation with each other. I'd like to see more spring up, and I'd like to us to have more conversations together. I know that there are conversations, say, in the UK that find their fruition in literature and theology, and that interests me a great deal because my specialty is actually British poetry, and I can feel the difference in that particular conversation that goes on. I can't remember. I wrote down the acronym. It's the ISRLC, the International Society for Religion, Literature, and Culture. That's an important society there. And, you know, I wish we could tap into their discussions more frequently and have a kind of global event. Maybe the virtuality that we're all more comfortable with now after the pandemic will allow for that. I'm hoping that there are benefits arising. But there are definite differences between conversations in the UK about even something like poetry and theology, which you would think would be a rather intimate field. It's my field. They're very different from the ones in the US. And so I long for more information about how others are thinking. So the more journals, the better, but I hope they don't just grow up in their spot and stay there.
Yeah, okay, good. You mentioned how you'd like to see the journal Religion and Literature continue to evolve in becoming more inclusive. Do you see the field of religion, literature and religion changing in that direction, or is your aspiration for it something which is kind of pushing against the grain of the field or trying to sort of lift the field from the gravity that keeps it in certain other traditions and disciplines?
I'm respectful of some of those forms of gravity, the attempt to in some circles within religion and literature studies to keep focused on tradition and doctrine. In my own field, if I were to turn to it as an illustration, there are young folks, even you know folks that have graduated from Notre Dame, who are quite keen to preserve a certain sense of, again, doctrinal faithfulness in their, both in their criticism and seeing it in the writing that they're looking at, the poets that they're reading or whatever. They want to be sure that they somehow circle the wagons and not allow for broader readings of certain kinds of authors. I think that's the one creeping tendency that scares me slightly. I think there must be, you know, again, an attempt to keep reading deep into the traditions that these authors in religion and literature studies are devoted to, and I think are remarkable for keeping alive and allowing to still speak to us. But I do worry about certain conservative tendencies. You're hearing me say, I didn't want to use that word, but you're hearing me say it. Those, I think, are always going to be with us. But I want to see a more adventurous, more experimental, and a more broadly thinking mindset going forward.
Right. The great irony in a lot of these things is that, you know, the more experimental and the more adventurous, the more it reinforces the importance of religion, the more it conserves the field. You know, the paradox mm-hmm. is the more these things find a way to talk to each other, the stronger the health, right, of the field is actually. Mm-hmm. You've been working for a while now on a project that involves postmodern theory, theology, and poetry. I wonder if you could tell us about that project a little bit and what you want its contribution to the field to be. Is that okay? Is that an okay question?
I just want the thing published at this point. It's a dozen years old. It's taken my life. No. I, and your listeners must keep remembering that my primary field is avant-garde poetics. So of course I'm, you know, even at my age, I'm still a radical. So I come in on figures like the great Anglo-Welsh poet David Jones.
Right.
Sometimes with, unfortunately, not enough post-criticality, but a little bit of edge when I find folks wanting to read him entirely as a kind of, again, conservative poet, when in the UK he is revered for being a mid-century avant-gardist and experimental writer, you know, in the vein of folks like Ezra Pound. So I read David Jones for what I think was remarkably forward-looking in his Catholicism, which he had converted to and which he adored beyond his life. But nonetheless, he's a poet, and the way he thinks about his Catholicism is so illuminating. And because he's a poet, he thinks about even things like the Eucharist in such a bewilderingly new way, even as it keeps fidelity to the most ancient of ways, that I think I'm sad when we don't take into account what poetry can add to theology, how thinking poetically can speak to theology and broaden, expand, beautify theology too. But I read him as quite a remarkable thinker who democratized some ways of thinking about Catholicism, and who had some radical ideas about how meaning is made. So that's my intervention. I think I work exclusively on avant-garde poets because they can be most daring. You know, they don't expect to be read. and they're rigorous readers of philosophy and theology, and you know, they read well beyond the usual kind of mark for more popular, more well read poets. They're demanding on their readers, but that's because they're synthesizing an awful lot, and that's what I'm drawn to, is trying to understand, you know, how does somebody who's devoted to thinking about poetry at its most, you know, radical edge, keep religion alive, even from its most doctrinal roots, keep it alive. How does that happen? and I think it's hopeful. It gives me hope that religion will survive whatever we can throw at it, like all that literary theory that I love so much in the 1990s, which didn't do it in.
That's right. It kind of reminds me of what you said early in our conversation, right? That it was poetry, really, that for you opened up theology. And a lot of what's nice for me to see is that, you know, now as a really a mature scholar who's made all kinds of contributions to the field and really knows what she's doing, you still find yourself going back to a lot of those roots. On that subject, if you were beginning your career today, you know, if you were starting over, would this be a project in the field you took up? Would you devote your career and work again to religion and literature, or would you direct your energies elsewhere?
I think of a late poem by Fanny Howe, a convert to Catholicism among our avant-garde poets here in the U.S., who ends a book with a little prayer that starts, "Teacher, can I have more time to learn my lesson in?" I wish I had started earlier in this work. I wish I had learned several more languages. I wish I had Hebrew. I wish I had Arabic. I wish so many things. I wish I had done a degree in theology. I wish I had read so much more than I could possibly read between my age now and when I'll leave this earth. But I couldn't be happier than being where I am, and I'm sure I'm not going to move from it until my last breath.
You speak to my own wishes. I wish too that I spoke Hebrew. I wish that I could also get a degree in theology. It would be fascinating, I think, for me to do. Alas, I just try to do a lot of reading around best I can and self-educate. And it's been very rewarding to have this job that I have that allows me to do precisely that. I feel very blessed by that. I guess I'll end by going back a little bit to your experience there at Notre Dame. And I'm talking to you from BYU. You're there at Notre Dame. We're both at religious universities. From your perspective, does Notre Dame have the same understanding of its religious mission as it did when you arrived? Or have you watched that sense of its mission change over the years?
Gosh, and I guess I have a long view of Notre Dame too, that many don't. It has changed so much over time, so much, even while certain things remain very powerfully the same and reassuringly the same. Again, that kind of openness, I think I sensed very early on. And again, it has to do with its ethos and deep-lying principles. But we've become so much more diverse. So thank God for that. The student body has also become so much more diverse. And so, you know, the challenge for us is great. I mean, I feel it every semester as I go back in the classroom. Am I serving my students? Am I talking to everybody in my classroom? It's Catholicism is still central, but I think that especially in our difficult times, the desire to know more about all kinds of others, both within our own country and outside it, is very, very powerful. The students are beginning to rebel at times. They want more diversity. And I think that can only be, you know, a tribute to what, you know, the university has been trying to promote all along, which is its own growth out of a fearful parochial provinciality and into being a truly international university, as it hopes to be. I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but maybe the pandemic has you know, caused us to think beyond the box even more effectively, and maybe we will use our virtuality to achieve this almost impossible goal of being truly global. And I Notre Dame has a really, really deep desire to do that.
That certainly is my wish. You know, for us at BYU, the pandemic, just speaking here really locally, just about the Humanities Center, it's caused us to take up podcasting, which is why we're talking to you today. And this has been really one of the great outcomes of this forced change of behavior, forced change of schedule and of programming for us. It's been a blessing. It's so great to talk to you, Ramana. You know, I am an admirer of your great work in the field, both as a scholar and a teacher and an editor at the journal. And thank you for coming on here today and talking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Sam Jacob. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you're interested in other episodes of this podcast or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.